Hello and welcome to another episode of Consumer, the European podcast of the Consumer Choice Centre. I'm your host, Bill Wirtz, on the last episode of the year, happening on the last day of the year 2020. This is episode 6, meaning that this podcast has been broadcasted for 6 weeks now. I hope you've been enjoying the content so far. If you are, please leave a resounding review wherever you listen to podcasts and make sure to follow the Consumer Choice Centre on all social media channels. December 31st, that means we are coming to the end of many people's holidays. I sure hope 2021 has better surprises waiting for us. For those of you who are pessimistic, I can only tell you we'll all get at least one birthday, so that's an upside. In any way, I'm certainly very thankful for all of those who have been subscribing and listening regularly. There's a lot of work that goes into these episodes, so I do appreciate any feedback. My guest this week is my CCC colleague David Clement. He is the North American Affairs Manager and English-speaking Canadian-in-Chief of the Consumer Choice Centre. We will be talking about CANZIC, that is the proposed free trade deal between Canada, New Zealand, Australia and the United Kingdom. But more of that later on. First, the European Union's new plastic tax will come into effect tomorrow. You'll see this new tax often described as an EU tax that you will pay directly as a consumer into the Treasury of Brussels. And while that is indirectly true, it's important to understand how it works. The plastic tax charges a tax of 80 euro cents per kilo of plastic packaging. So that doesn't mean everything made out of plastic, just plastic packaging, and only applies to non-recyclable plastic packaging. So who exactly pays this tax? Well, the EU does not give clear directions on that because the EU cannot implement taxes in member states. Of course, it seems reasonable that member states tax the manufacturers, but theoretically, they only need to send the required annual amount to the EU, which calculates the amount based on the amount of non-recyclable plastic packaging that was consumed in each country. So the tax was decided, actually, at the European Council summit back in July when the EU leaders were struggling to find new revenue streams to fund the biggest budget in EU history. This tax will raise between 6 and 8 billion euros a year, which is hardly enough to fund all the EU programs accounted for right now. I personally don't think that this tax will do anything good. Those EU countries with industries producing non-recyclable plastic packaging will find a way to subsidize these companies anyway, possibly even with EU funds. The people who will actually pay this tax are the consumers who will once again pay more for food, drinks, or hygiene products. What we should do is be tougher on plastic pollution. The pollution is the actual problem that we are actually trying to solve, and which should face tougher fines for those who are doing the actual polluting. If you're dumping plastic packaging into a river or sea, you need to be held accountable for those actions. Here's the French member of the European Parliament, Valérie Ayer, from the centrist group back in July, showing us that this tax was a pressure point to raise more money for the EU budget. The segment is in French, direct translation into English.
Our political family will be vigilant on two points in particular. These will govern whether or not we support this agreement between states. First of all, own resources, in the plural, to reimburse the loan. We will not simply accept loans. Now, I know it isn't easy to have a common position here. It isn't in this assembly either, but we have done it. We've overcome our differences. Sometimes we've had to calibrate our ambitions so that we can move forward. Today, it is urgent to have these as grants without weighing on future generations. That has to be the guiding star for this negotiation. Let us put the burden on GAFA or the multinationals who practice aggressive tax planning.
This new plastic tax that is coming in tomorrow is just a, in my view, a desperate way to raise new revenue in a non-sustainable way. I mean, this is not very complicated to understand. If you're taxing something that you'd like to disappear, then it's not a secure revenue stream. But the EU simultaneously says the plastic tax is part of a new revenue stream to fund the EU independently of the negotiations with member states. But then it also says that non-recyclable plastic packaging should disappear. Well, which one is it? You can't have it both ways. Anyway, not trying to get too riled up here. Another story I'd like to cover here on the Consumer Podcast is the COVID-19 vaccine. Some of you will know that the most prominent of the current vaccines against COVID-19 have been arrived through genetic engineering, or what many of you will know as GMOs. As a supporter of scientific innovation, I think that's great, but it did take some convincing for the European Parliament at first. Many of you will know that genetic engineering is highly regulated in the EU, especially when it comes to food production. So let's go back in time to the faraway place of June, when the European Parliament's Committee on Food Safety debated a possible derogation for GMOs in vaccine trials. So this derogation means that usually GMOs would not be allowed in clinical trials for vaccines, but that this time will make an exception. Here's Swedish Social Democrat parliamentarian Jytte Guteland.
We support the temporary derogation that the Commission has proposed for clinical trials and medical products of treat or prevent for COVID-19 from some of the rules that currently apply to trials during involvation of GMOs.
More critical was Italian Conservative parliamentarian Luisa Reggimenti from the Lega Party. Direct translation here from Italian into English.
I'm concerned about the temporary derogation for complying with GMO requirements for the anti-COVID vaccine. Does the Commission not think that this derogation is rather dangerous or risky?
And last but not least, I got Czech parliamentarian Kateřina Konečná from the far-left group for you.
Current GMO legislation does not foresee situations of urgency, and I can assure you that there is a very good reason for this. The GUE NGL is always strictly against the authorization of the GMOs on the internal market. However, in the light of this particular crisis, we are open to make an exemption for our strict approach towards the GMOs. Nevertheless, our flexibility is not unconditional. One of our biggest concerns, and correct me if I am wrong, is that these new relaxed rules will apply not only for clinical trials on a COVID-19 vaccine, but also for the treatments. Why? Do I understand it correctly that the vaccine itself could be a GMO?
Before I tell you more about what the committee debated here, let's listen into what Health Commissioner Stella Kyriakides from Cyprus had to say about the said derogation.
This is a derogation that is specific to COVID-19. I understand the concerns, but we are also very aware that the application of the GMO framework has shown limitations. But in the light of the public health emergency, we needed a specific proposal in order to facilitate critical clinical trials with medicinal products, yes, therapeutics and vaccines, specifically for COVID-19 as swiftly as possible. And I can understand and fully respect your concerns, but we are facing a public health emergency. And in public health emergencies, you have extraordinary situations and you need extraordinary and exceptional measures.
So in my view, the debate in the European Parliament is overshadowed by some pretty remarkable double standards. The bottom line is that the EU does not allow genetic engineering in general medical practice nor in our food. But for this specific one-time emergency, we'll make an exception. How exactly is the vaccine to fight COVID-19 different in terms of risks associated with genetic engineering? Through this derogation, both the European Commission and the European Parliament are actually admitting what scientists already know. The EU's opposition to genetic engineering is purely political and is not based in any scientific understanding of genetics. If the technology is good enough for a COVID-19 vaccine, then it's good enough for other medical and agricultural applications. On that note, a little teaser for my audience, the CCC will soon release a new policy note on genetic engineering, so stay tuned on all of our social media channels to get word of that. In other news then, the EU is trying to coordinate over UK travel bans. A new COVID-19 mutant strain is apparently more infectious than the existing disease. So numerous countries had gone ahead and banned UK travellers. Here's Deutsche Welle reporting.
Now, the measures are already causing havoc at airports and other travel hubs in the UK, which is now effectively cut off from continental Europe. Now, the governments of Ireland, France, Belgium, the Netherlands, also Denmark, Germany and Poland also on this list, Austria, Italy and also Bulgaria. All these countries are barring entry for people who are traveling from Britain. More are expected to follow suit. The new coronavirus mutation is believed to spread more quickly, forcing the British government to impose a strict lockdown on the capital, London, and nearby areas.
Some journalists were also affected at the beginning of these travel bans, which are being reconsidered or have already been reconsidered. In fact, the European Commission put out a statement advising against travel bans for people arriving from the UK, saying that appropriate measures to deal with international travel are already in place. And I agree, we need to uphold international travel in Europe and not fall back into border closures. In fact, I'm personally very worried that we've opened the Pandora's box of quick virus response, because it means that at the slightest appearance of a new disease, we'll lock down the economy, close borders, and ruin people's livelihoods. I don't believe that it's the right precedent to set here, but before I get into sharing my grievances with you, let me get to the interview of this week. My guest is the CCC's own David Clement, with whom I talked about the proposed CANZUC Free Trade Agreement. So David, tell us, what exactly is CANZUC?
So CANZUC is the concept that Canada, the United Kingdom, New Zealand, and Australia would come together in a multilateral agreement that would allow for the free movement of goods and labor, the free movement of people in terms of tourism, some cross-collaboration in terms of national security, and collaboration in terms of military cooperation. And what makes it interesting, and this is why it's relevant to the conversation about Brexit and the EU, is that it in my opinion, takes all of the great things from the EU without a lot of the negative. So there's no common currency, there's no central government, there's no multinational regulatory board. It very much is in the classical liberal sense of a free trade agreement, much more in line with those kind of historical roots of free trade rather than what would be like the managed trade approach or the very heavy-handed regulatory trade approach, which some people, whether it's right or wrong, have criticized the EU for being. So for CANZUC, it's a unique opportunity for those four countries to come together in economic partnership and really benefit from the gains from trade, but then also have some other pretty interesting spillover effects as well.
So how similar are, because I mean, these countries are very far apart, so how similar are these systems really? Can you expect that all the products and services have sort of the same standards in Canada than they have in the UK? How would you describe that? How do you see that happening?
Yeah, so, I mean, they're all developed countries. We all share a common language. Canada being the one major exception in terms of the population of the country who speaks French in Quebec. We all, relatively speaking, have a common culture, so Commonwealth roots. Not that argument is persuasive for me, but it is certainly true that the four countries are unique in terms of their similarities. So they are quite similar. And what is interesting about CANZUC, and this is really what part of the reason why I like the proposal, is that included in it, so it's not just the free movement of goods and free trade, it's also reciprocity in terms of licensing. I mean, things like occupational licensing, whether you're a plumber or a real estate agent or you're in some licensed trade, being able to work in any of those four countries, which is really like, from an outsider to the EU, that's one of the real benefits of the EU, is that you're a citizen of Europe, you have a French passport, you can work elsewhere, your job opportunities are not endless, but they're certainly pretty vast, and the same thing goes for employers. So being able to look abroad for the best talent. So if a country has I use the example of Australia has a pretty well-developed mining sector. So does Canada. It would be in our best interest if there was cross-collaboration there and engineers could work either in Australia or Canada. Same thing goes for different agricultural products and pretty much anything under the sun. It just allows for more movement and a much more fluid job market on both sides of the employment equation.
So I remember when I used this tool to see what countries I can go and live in and work in, and it's actually, Canada is quite restrictive. You know, it's not that easy to just move to Canada and start working. So that is actually an incredible benefit that will be then afforded to citizens of the UK. How do you see CANZUC in the process now? Because I remember when we had the discussion in Europe about CETA, this is the trade agreement between the European Union and Canada, it took quite some time and it was facing a lot of opposition. Do you see the same happening for CANZUC, or is this going to be smooth sailing?
I'm not sure if it's going to be smooth sailing, but one positive is that the leader of the Conservative Party here in Canada, Aaron O'Toole, did make CANZUC part of his kind of core platform when he sought the leadership of the party. And so it is a priority, in his own words. Now, he's not the prime minister. He may as well be after the next federal election. We don't know. And we don't know really when that will be. But there seems to be some good support from the Conservative side. And I would argue that there should be support from the Liberal side as well, because most listeners probably wouldn't know this, but Liberals in Canada were very critical of the UK for leaving the EU, and were overwhelmingly Remainers. And I think that they had good reasons to hold that position. So if you were lecturing the Brits about why they needed to remain, you can't do that while also opposing CANZUC. So there is some cognitive dissonance there from our friends on the left in terms of the value of CANZUC. And so in my opinion, this should be something that unites both the center-right and the center-left. I do expect that you will see opposition from the populist right and then the populist left. So in Canada, that would be the New Democratic Party, who are kind of like your European socialists, and then the farther right, which they don't really have representation in parliament, but they would oppose CANZUC on the grounds of opposing free trade and looking at things through a very nationalistic lens, which I think is really silly. And what is interesting from my point of view is that we're at a unique point in time, and everybody's talking about the Great Reset and bold ideas and what we want to do next and how do we pull ourselves out of some pretty ugly fiscal positioning. Well, I think we should, rather than look inward, which is what many politicians are suggesting, rather than looking inward and becoming more nationalistic, we should look outward and expand our trade and cooperation initiatives with these other three countries. And I think that that has a tremendous potential in terms of economic growth. And really, it's going to be economic growth that decides the path that we take after the pandemic has subsided, and really how ugly the economic toll is going to be really hinges on how focused are we on pro-growth policies and how committed are we to that. CANZUC is a great pro-growth policy in that sense. And so I think that it couples, CANZUC was a great argument before COVID, but it's especially great after COVID, given our need to focus on economic growth.
So how does that look in practice then? Because now Canada will be in the, if this goes through, Canada will be in the unique position of having both a trade agreement with the European Union, but also one with the United Kingdom. What does that change in my, as a Canadian consumer, what does that change in my supermarkets, availability of services? Have you already seen with CETA any changes, or is that still pending? Like how... Just lay us out for consumers. What does a free trade agreement mean for them in practice on a day-to-day basis?
Yeah, so we haven't seen much, I would say, in terms of CETA. There may be things that are unseen, but you're not. I don't all of a sudden see products with a French flag on it on the supermarket shelf in abundance in any way that we didn't before. But what I can say in terms of the practicality of this, which what is great, is It's actually just adding. So Kanzuk is, although when I describe it, it sounds like a bold and some would maybe even call it a radical idea. But there is a pre-existing agreement between Australia and New Zealand that operates on this premise. And Kanzuk is just adding two more countries to that mix. So the framework exists, the relationship exists. It's not something this is not like the creation of the EU, which was quite the endeavor. This is something that where the model exists, it's just adding two countries to it. And so my opinion is that we would see quicker benefits from a Kanzuk style agreement because it doesn't necessarily come at it from that managed trade perspective. So Canada and the United States renegotiated NAFTA. It's one of the greatest trading relationships in the world, but that doesn't mean that there aren't issues and it isn't a rocky relationship and there are goods that we maybe want to have less access for and goods that we want to have more access for. So it could be quite complicated and burdensome and takes a long time and there are disputes and dispute mechanisms and things like that. Because Kanzuk is just adding two countries into a pre-existing agreement, it's a lot less complicated. So I think we would see a quicker rollout of goods and services available from these other countries. And again, that matters because the quicker you can get things moving, the more likely you are to have some economic growth as a result of the agreement.
And that concludes the last episode of Consumer for the year 2020. Thank you so much for listening and subscribing. I will continue to host this show every week, so stay tuned for great shows and guests. I'm your host, Bill Woods. See you Thursday. You have to learn to pace yourself. Pressure. You just